Turning our attention to weather and climate. It must be the last Monday of the month.
The last and the last Monday of the year.
The last Monday of the year. All right.
A wonderful, exciting weather year.
A wonderful and exciting weather year. Steve Ackerman, professor and director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. And I might add, the recipient of the NASA's Exceptional Service Award. And also John Martin, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. With us, as they always come on the last Monday of the month, to talk weather and climate. Today is no exception. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Well, glad to have you guys back.
Yeah, glad to be back, Larry.
It's great to be back.
Yeah. As we look back, this is the time of year we always kind of look back, and as we think about the weather and climate for this past year, anything unusual, or what are your thoughts?
I think the first thing that hits me is the record-breaking storm in late October.
Yeah,
which was
too.
Kind of a dry October, and then all of a sudden, boom.
Amazing event. It's going to refashion the way we look at how the tropics and extratropics interact on a day-to-day basis, not on a seasonal basis. It's a revolution about to occur by studying that event. So I agree. That's the number one weather event of the year.
So we
had part of the world.
And we had what? How much rain and...
Yeah, that's right. Summer was in most places in Wisconsin. This was this rainiest summer.
Yeah.
This past year. So that's kind of, and also very high dew points during the summer too.
Yeah,
in July,
summer.
In particular, we had that string where almost half of July had dew points above 70 degrees Fahrenheit,
which is unusual.
Yeah, that's kind of
a long
like
stretch for us. Yeah. Although you go a few miles south, it's commonplace.
So we're right
at that boundary, and we were invited in this summer.
An invite I really didn't want to accept. It's kind of like vampires, you know, stay out.
Nobody likes that.
Now somebody's going to say, all right, my memory's kind of short. What is it? What was that October event that you're talking about? Describe that for us.
That October 26th cyclone event, where I think the most memorable part of it, I think for us, was it wasn't very rainy. We had rain for sure, but it wasn't very rainy. It was just windy. We had wind gusts over 70 miles per hour, widespread wind gusts in the region over 60. So there was a lot of damage that way. And the biggest thing, I think the headlining thing, was it had one of the lowest sea level pressures ever recorded, in a non-tropical storm over the continental United States. So it was really... Maybe it was more of a weather geek event than it was a day-to-day person event. It could have been, but nonetheless, it'll change the way we look at weather systems, I think, in a fairly profound way.
And I think this is also the second most tornadoes that Wisconsin
has had.
I don't remember what the number is, but I'm pretty sure we were.
Yeah, it was something almost 60, I think.
That's right.
So it was pretty high up there. And the other thing that I remember about this past year is the fact that we had our big event that closed the university, big snow event, December 8th and 9th. And then it didn't snow again, effectively, all winter long.
Oh, right.
It was really, that's not quite true, of course, but it was a pretty boring winter in terms of the snow.
Last winter.
2009 to 2010, yeah. And we're off to a sort of a middling start now.
Cold, persistently cold.
I'd say that's really the watchword for December 2010. But not a great amount of snow, but not zero. It's been snow on the ground for most of the last 3 weeks of the month.
Yeah, that's right.
And if I'm not mistaken, and this I knew would pass because we just got new cross-country skis for my daughter, that there's going to be even a rain event later this week, temperatures are going to go up. And
yeah, you better get out there skiing.
I would recommend
you better
that.
Leave early.
I would definitely recommend that. Yeah, Thursday and Friday, especially Friday, mid to high 40s with rain.
Which produces a potential for flooding because all the snow will melt. And if it'll be frozen, ground will be frozen. It'll be hard to remove that water.
How often does that happen? This time of...
That's not that uncommon, actually.
It is not.
Yeah,
okay.
It's really not. You know, I mean, we can get into prolonged periods where it stays cold. Like we're just coming out of one now. When we get into this warm spell in early January, and it may be momentary, it may be associated with just the passage of this one storm. But if the storms come to our west as opposed to over Chicago or over Detroit, we are on the warm side of them. And it happens, some regularity in the wintertime.
You know, I'm thinking back to my youth, and always in this part of the state, there was tobacco growing and still is, actually. And in January, there was what farmers would call case weather. And that was when it would you'd get a warm spell and then you'd get a lot of moisture in the air. And that was the time or is the time when the farmers who raised tobacco would take it out of the shed because the leaves would have more moisture in it. Then it wouldn't be so brittle.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. And you'd strip the leaves off the stalks and bale them up. And it was always in January. You always
like
figured you got a little case weather, they call it.
I mean, there is the January thaw that actually shows up in our Madison mean temperatures in the late 20s, January 20-something. You see this blip of general warming.
But not every year. Of course, then there are some years where that week from the 20th to the 27th is the coldest week of the whole winter. So that happens, too.
Right.
But overall, you get this characteristic of what happens in the mid-winter is you get a high-amplitude flow that can get you really cold one week and then really warm
the
either the prior or the next week. Yeah.
Let's go to Peter in Kingston, who has a comment or question. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I was wondering about down in Florida, they've been seeing a lot of these balls of light that look like a rainbow, and it seems to be associated with these jets that are flying and spraying some sort of aerosol, and I was wondering maybe if you had any idea what those guys were doing down there and why that ball of like a rainbow shows up when they spray that stuff.
Maybe that's sun dogs that come out of contrails.
Oh, that could be. That could be, yeah.
And that could happen anywhere, and it's probably just the fact that some of the condensate that comes out of the exhaust of these jet aircraft forms ice particles in the high-altitude atmosphere. And in the right ambient humidity conditions, it can lead to a little bit of growth or coating of some of those human-produced ice particles. And then you get refraction of sunlight through them, and they produce stuff that looks like mother of pearl or sun dogs. So they are a form of light phenomena. Steve knows a lot about those things.
Yeah.
I know less.
Yeah, I was trying to think of what else it could be, and that seems like a good guess.
Mm. All right. Yeah. So there you go. Thanks, Peter. And Maggie in Blue River, we turn to you. Hi, Maggie.
Hi. I was wondering if either of you had seen an article, I think it was in the New York Times, I think it was yesterday, about a phenomenon that isn't being taken into account with seasonal prediction of weather events that goes on in Siberia.
I saw that, yeah.
It fluctuates the Gulf Stream or the jet stream, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
Would you talk about that?
Yeah, I don't know.
I didn't see it.
It's written by Judah Cohen, who I know. I know him when he was a graduate student. I forget now where he went to school, but I've known him for a number of years. He's a little bit like me in the sense that he's a real snow freak. This is a guy who's been interested in snow since he was a small kid growing up in New York City. So maybe some of what he says is tainted by that enthusiasm. But he did alert my attention to something I hadn't thought very obviously about. And here's that the fundamental level is what caught my eye. In a warmer earth, in a warmer climate, the air, broadly speaking, over the whole globe will be more full of water vapor than it would be in a colder climate. That includes even at high latitudes, where one of the consequences of an overall warmer globe may well be that you get greater snows at the high latitudes. And here we're talking about the northern hemisphere high latitudes for our winter. And so his claim is, and I'd love to see the data that supports this, and I'm sure he's right about it because he's interested in snow, he says that the extent of the snow cover in the northern hemisphere has increased. Even though the ice, the Arctic sea ice, goes down, the landmass that's covered by snow during the early part of the winter has been extended over the last couple of decades. And as a consequence, he says, that makes it easier to form really cold Arctic air masses than it was 50 years ago. And that might be what underlies some of these extreme cold spells that seem to be coming in the context of otherwise warmer than average years. It's a reasonable hypothesis if all those pieces link together the way that he suggests they do.
So is it northern hemisphere? Because I thought northern hemisphere snow cover was generally decreasing.
I guess he's suggesting it's the opposite, that the ice cover is decreasing. But that's a much longer scale, presence.
Right.
So that the snow can be momentary and that the extent of the snow cover is actually larger in a warmer climate. because you're in the way I thought about it is, well, it makes sense. There's always going to be storms at high latitudes.
Right, yeah.
They tend to be moisture starved. So if you inject just a little bit more water vapor in them, perhaps because the atmosphere in general is a little bit more water laden, you're going to have more snowfall out of them.
Huh.
So that makes some sense to me.
Well, I'll have to go read
it. So that could be. It could be what's actually going on.
Well, do you remember the guy's name?
Yeah, Judah Cohen. J-U-D-A-H-C-O-H-E-N.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And going along with that, Carol in Wisconsin Rapids emailed in. She says she has a theory that extra heat in the atmosphere from climate change is causing more water to be absorbed and more precipitation to fall to Earth as a result. Is that feasible?
That's one of the things they're looking at with warmer climates. As the air gets warmer, usually, as John was just saying, there's more moisture in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And so if you can get the right dynamics, and there's the key, you also want to get the vertical lifting of the air that allows clouds to form and precipitation to form.
Yeah, and people, I think with a lot of different space-based instruments, trying to figure out if there actually is, we don't have as long a record, but is there an increasing tendency for precipitation to, I mean, the amount of precipitation, say, in the tropics to increase over the last 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, or does it remain the same? It's just that it becomes more extreme.
Yeah,
so you get a very long dry periods, and then it rains, and it rains a lot and makes up for the total amount you'd normally get.
Yeah. All right. Ruth in Rochester, Minnesota, let's go on to you now. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The reason I was calling is I've noticed over the years, and I'm an older woman, that the winters have gotten so much shorter. Like last year, it really didn't start being solid winter until almost December. And by the 1st of March, we've seen our last snowfall. And I noticed this year, you know, it starts later, it's heavier, but then it disappears much quicker. It's a much shorter winter. Can they explain that?
Yeah, I think it depends on how you define when winter begins and when it ends. You know, do you define it by the snowfall amount or what the mean temperature is?
I think by how cold it gets. I'm a gardener.
Ah, okay. So, yeah,
you know, I'm a farmer. So I noticed that, you know, after first frost, there's a leg before it gets really cold.
Yeah.
And then you start seeing snowfall and... I'm also a truck driver, and I noticed that it's extreme in December. It lightens up a little bit in January, and we always, in this part of the country, had March was always, you know, a tournament time. You could always almost count on a blizzard or a snow event or something.
Yeah.
And we're not seeing a lot of that anymore.
Hmm. Yeah, there was some work done by Chris Kucharik, and somebody looking at the changes in Wisconsin and upper Minnesota temperatures. And what they're finding in the wintertime is that it's that extreme colder temperatures that are not occurring or occurring less frequently. So it's I mean, one way to look at it is it's not so much that Wisconsin is getting warmer. I mean, it is, but it's also not getting as cold, which makes it, on average, seem warmer.
Yeah,
but I would say this winter began early.
Yeah, I would too. I mean, we've had a cold December here. It's been persistently cold this month. We've not really had any mild days at all. We may get one by Friday, but that's going to be about it. And
we used to see this stuff by deer hunting season in November. You know, a lot of deer hunting with snow cover and cold. I don't see the 20 below zero temperatures that we used to see for a long period of time.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's certainly some truth to the, especially when you get that far into the early part of the season, that second week in November or something. I think there probably are some notable differences between now and then.
And we can talk some more about that. We need to take a quick break to look at the news, and we'll be back with our two guests, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network, talking weather and climate today with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the UW-Madison. Great to have them along. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John chairs the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And that question about the basketball tournament and weather, but we've got some callers who have been waiting a while, so let's take those calls. Mm-hmm. Then we'll come back to the tournament issue. Brett in Wausau, you're up. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. I have a question about a story that I've been hearing that some scientific research counting sunspots and the solar energy from the sun actually has been diminishing, and so therefore it could be leading us into a cold spell, a lot like the little ice age a few hundred years ago. I'm a proponent of global warming. I believe that, you know, humans are contributing to that. How do you respond to this research that's, you know, directly linked to global cooling?
Well, there are two issues here, I think. One is that latter question about, you know, natural variability might look at the solar activity that that cycles anywhere from 26,000-year periodicities to 100,000-year periodicities. And so even though we may be in a solar cycle that is leading towards a cooling, or the fact is actually we're actually, one may classify us as still being in an ice age, right? Because there's still glaciers around, ice ages around. But it doesn't mean that, you know, superimposed on that is another activities that are going on associated with human activities that could be increasing the temperature of the Earth. Now, with regard to sunspots specifically, those run through cycles. It's called a 22-year cycle, but the number of sunspots is actually an 11-year cycle. And we've just come out of a real longer-than-expected period of minimum sunspots. But the number of sunspots has been, again, starting to increase again, and I think is expected to peak, well, it must be about 5 years from now or so.
Yeah, okay. About 5 years.
Yeah, but a lot of looking actually for a lot of solar activity in 2012.
And so sunspots are what?
I like to think of them as just blemishes on the sun. And so there are areas that are associated with the convective activity of the sun, and they run through periodicities, and they're generally darker, cooler spots that exist on the surface of the sun.
So that means there's less solar output when the complexion is more dotted with these sunspots. Is that right?
Generally, yeah. Okay. Right. Yep.
There you go, Brett.
Have you
got it?
Well, yeah. I think what this report was kind of leading into is that, and again, this is maybe one researcher, one scientist, but how it's actually dangerous if we don't. Take care in reducing human-caused emissions that will contribute to global warming. If we don't take care to, reduce those, if we actually go into a moment of global cooling, when we come out of it, it will be actually very, very severe. And that's the conclusion that was put together. And I wish I knew where I heard this. I think it was either something like 60 Minutes or 20 or NPR. So,
yeah.
I really like Steve's point though about the superposition of these various processes going on. Some of which we can understand better because they're very, very proximate to our own experience. We can measure the composition of the Earth. We know something about how it behaves radiatively. We don't know quite as much about the sun, and so you know there's things going on there that maybe are a little bit less in focus than the ones that are. That are definitely conspiring to warm the planet, but they may be working against each other. It's possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Brett, for calling. Appreciate it. Louise in Kenosha, let's turn to you next. Hi, Louise.
Well, hi. I had a comment and a question. I was up in Minneapolis over the weekend, and then the caller who was talking about how winter seemed shorter to her made me want to call and say that when I was listening to the public radio station up in the Twin Cities, they had a weather show, and they were talking about how the ice breakup of the lake, northern lakes up there, had been earlier than ever before for the last 2 years. And I was wondering if Wisconsin has similar records about that.
Yeah, we
can do better than that. John Magnuson, who's a professor of limnology on our campus, has studied lakes in the northern hemisphere over the last 150 years, dating back to 1850. I think the study was published in the year 2000. That's characteristic of lakes everywhere in the northern hemisphere. And I guess the average ice-off date is about 9 days earlier, and the average ice-on is about 7 days later.
Yeah, so that's like 2 weeks difference.
Yeah, almost more than two full weeks difference in the length of the winter as measured at those various 130, locations. around the Northern Hemisphere as measured by when the ice comes on and off at those big lakes. So there's definitely something afoot, and that's a really hard record to argue with. I don't know how you can get around the conclusions from that. It's not every year, of course. It varies up and down, but on average, over 150 years times 35 big lakes or whatever it was, that's a lot of samples, and you've got something going on. So it's consistent with what you're saying.
Yeah, it's consistent here as it is in Minneapolis and Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. And again, there's a little variation this year, thinking in Madison, Lake Mendota froze over
earlier.
Yeah, by quite a bit, I think.
So there is, and this is the thing with climate and weather. I mean, weather varies a lot from year to year, and that's the important part of looking at climate is not to look at 1 year or even a couple of months. You got to look at the long time period. But I'm really encouraged by the fact that I have not yet heard the phrase, what happened to global warming?
Yeah, right.
Nobody's saying that, which means I think people are finally understanding that you just can't look at these isolated events and then claim that the Earth isn't warming anymore. So that's the good news.
Well, Paul Kinzer, somebody I know pretty well from Galesville, Wisconsin. Paul, hi.
Hey, hello there.
Good to have you with us. And you got a comment about sunspots?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I heard wrong a couple of minutes ago talking about the sunspots. Actually, the more sunspots there are, the more solar activity is going on. There's all sorts of magnetic stuff going on. So we're coming out of a low activity period and heading into a higher activity period.
I think I might have said that, and I don't know about it. I think we said it the other way. Yeah.
Fewer sunspots.
But when you have more sunspots, do you have as much radiation in the visible spectrum?
Well, no, you may not, but that's when you get these huge bursts of solar activity, and that's what causes northern lights.
Yeah, so there's more magnet.
They are on their way up, and the whole thing with solar activity and global warming, it's been looked at again and again, and there is no connection between the two.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to get that in there.
Thanks, Paul. Yeah,
actually, associated with sunspots are things called faculae or something like that.
Right.
They're usually the high-energy stuff that emit.
And if you look at the sun in other wavelengths other than visible, you can the sunspots actually look brighter under some wavelengths. So.
Oh, right.
Okay.
Thanks, Paul.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thanks.
Bye-bye. Paul's been a regular, frequent guest on our program to talk about the stars and the sky.
That's what we like. Yeah. We know about the atmosphere, but once we get out into space, we begin to stumble sometimes.
Untethered.
Right.
You can join in, by the way, if you have a question or comment at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. Tom in Mequon, let's go to you now. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I hope this doesn't sound like too silly of a question, but I had heard that there's some that maybe all these windmills are changing the weather because they're a direct opposing force against the natural flow of the winds, and I'm wondering what your guests had heard about that.
I know there's people who study the influence of wind towers and windmills on very, very local aspects of the weather that have to do maybe with how the water vapor coming out of a cornfield will be transported downstream and things like that. I think they're at this level, at the level they're doing the research now, it's on the very, very fine scale, tens of meters scale, boundary layer sort of things, somewhat esoteric compared to, and I only say that word, compared to the large scale flow of the atmosphere. I think they don't have very much influence at all. It's a pinprick compared to some of the forces that conspire to bring the wind across the Great Plains.
Yeah.
So, but locally, within a mile or two radius?
Yeah, locally they have some effect. If you're going to, let's say somebody's burning leaves or something upstream of your windmill, the exact path of that smoke is going to be greatly altered by that. And so will any other constituent that comes from a factory, comes from a nearby city. So those are definitely worthwhile things to investigate, both after you've established the wind farm, hopefully more likely before you establish it, but not going to change the path of cyclones or do anything significant to the wind. The wind is driven by much larger scale forces.
There's this great photo that somebody down at the National Center for Atmospheric Research showed me once of a wind farm going on, and the conditions must have been just right so that saturation was close to occurring but wasn't occurring.
Mm.
But downwind of the wind farms, boom, there was fog.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it was just like complete opposite of what I expected.
Yeah.
So again, but that's going to be really local.
Those kind of things are cool, but they're very local. Yeah.
Thanks, Tom, for calling. Appreciate it. I want to go back to the basketball tournament that Ruth in Minnesota said, you know, we used to have, you know, you always expect a storm for the boys' basketball tournament in Minnesota, same in Wisconsin. Do we have any information on that?
Yeah, Steve and I write an article for the State Journal here in Madison every week. And one time in the spring, we did one on the basketball tournament. We got the help of Ed Hopkins, who's the assistant state climatologist, to look up the data for Madison. And Steve's hopefully got a better memory than me. In fact, it's almost a guarantee. No one has a worse memory than me, but I think I recall.
But we're talking about snow, John.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but not snow that I experienced as a kid, so it's hard for me to remember. I think that if we defined a snow as any snow event during that week, and it was the whole week of the tournament, it was 4 times out of 10, I think.
4 times out of 10.
And if it was a 4-inch snowfall or greater, I think it was 1.5 times out of 10 or something small like that for Madison. But the comment we made when Ruth was calling, I guess it was between calls, was that the Minneapolis Weather Service website actually has a little bit in their climatology section about tournament snowstorms in Minneapolis area, which is really interesting. So I didn't realize that other parts of the country have this same seeming phenomena. And it's not so common here, but it might be more common there.
And do you remember, was it the same type of statistics?
It's about the same. I think it's slightly more elevated. And that's consistent with my anecdotal sense that when we get a spring storm here in Madison, we're sometimes too far to the east or on the warm side, like we will be on Friday. Minneapolis is more likely to be on the west side, so they're more often than us. And so they'll get a few more of those snow events than we do. But it's not in another league, really.
So I think John is maybe forecasting snow in March.
Yeah. It doesn't happen every year, but it does happen some years.
4 out of 10. It's something. But it's the one that you always remember that.
That's the thing. Yeah. When you get stuck, those are the things you remember.
Yeah. So, you know, one always has to be careful. This is an important but larger point. One has to be careful about recollections that go back years and decades because, you get imprinted on the times that it really hit you and caused you either excitement or great peril.
Yeah.
You don't really remember sunny days during the basketball tournament.
Let's go to Willem and Colfax next. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I guess I'm just worried about this whole idea of climate change and all the people like, you know, right-wing radio talk show host Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, all these people sort of mocking the idea of global warming. And our newly elected senator, Ron Johnson, believes it's sunspot activity. And these are our leaders, and I think that if we don't address this issue as a, you know, as a society and maybe as a world, then it seems like we've been talking about this for 30 years or something, and nothing ever gets done. And I know you don't know the answer to this, but I assume that these people, when they're sick, they believe in science, but somehow they don't believe in science when it comes to climate change. And I don't know what the resistance is, if it's just that we don't like change or what the deal is. But it's very troubling, I think. And I don't know. I'd like to have some little thing I could say to people, you know, that explains it and it would be a good comeback to all these comments.
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking about this for a long time, too. And I've come to the conclusion that there's two ways of making arguments. One is a scientific argument and one is a political argument. When you make a scientific argument, you look at all the data. And from the data, you try to make a conclusion about what that data is telling you. When you make political arguments, you come from a point of view of this is what I want to tell people. And then you cherry pick pieces of information that support that.
That's right.
And I really think that that's what happens a lot with commentators. And it could happen both on the far right or on the far left. They're going to cherry pick pieces of information. And I think that that cherry picking then influences politicians so that either they have really bad science advisors or they only remember these facts that, as you're saying, sunspots are the cause of global warming. Well, we know that's not what's causing global warming. And so why is, you know, someone who's representing the state saying something like that of any state just drives me crazy, whether it's Wisconsin or Oklahoma. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Same with me. I couldn't agree more with what Steve just said, this cherry-picking lack of comprehensive analysis of what's available as evidence. And I hate to have the word believe or any you know cousin of it enter the discussion about global change. It's not a matter of belief. Religion is a matter of belief. This is a matter of weighing evidence, using analysis, and being rational about it. And that doesn't mean you come to a solid conclusion that you don't have any doubts about. It means that you come to a conclusion that you're 96% sure is in the right track. And that's good enough when you're doing science work, because that compels you to go out and get more observations to try and narrow that gap. Sometimes those new observations widen the gap, and then you realize, hey, maybe I was on the wrong track. But we've been at this for a long time, as you say, for about 30 years, and every time that an international group of skeptical thinkers gets together and puts their ideas together, they get more and more certain that they're on the right track. That's awfully hard to argue with. It doesn't mean we should stop arguing with it, but it sure means that when we come to the point where we're making decisions about policy and trying to get the most informed basis for making those policy decisions that we cannot pretend that assertion is the same as proof. Mm-hmm. And that's what these people are doing. They're asserting that their view is correct, and then they're not holding that assertion to the scrutiny of analysis. And that's unscientific. It's Middle Ages thinking. It's Aristotelian, and we have to stop doing it.
That's a big word, Aristotelian. Yeah. You're going to have to explain that to me later.
Yeah, Aristotle was a terrible scientist. Oh, okay, he did right, exactly yeah, that. Right. He'd say, this is what I think is happening in nature, and I'll go and scour the world for evidence that proves my point. I won't care about any ancillary stuff that comes along and might otherwise cloud the picture. That's terrible science.
It is, but it's apparently being done pretty regularly
yeah.
well, by a lot of people.
And you know, and again, the argument of what I think of as the political thought, if you really opposed to any kind of federal regulation, then, you know, if you realize and recognize that climate change is real and that A, that's A, and then B, we have to do something about it, well, that means you're going to have to do regulation. And if you're really against regulation,
yep, there you go.
Then, you know, you're going to try and convince people that, okay, well, it can't be real then, because if it is, then we have to do regulation.
Right, you're compelled to cherry pick.
Okay, right, yeah.
Exactly, because your conclusion is not rational.
So that's our political thinking from scientists, which you should probably take with a grain of salt.
Yeah, right. I think you're on the right track there. Mary emailed us and said, Newsweek has a photo of a volcano explosion from last year, and it is quite a photo. There are what appears to be lightning strikes within the picture.
I've seen that one. That's the Iceland volcano.
Are there lightning strikes within an eruption of a volcano?
Yes, there's a lot. And also within big major forest fires as well will also have lightning strikes. Lightning is a giant electrical spark that's very similar to what you get when you touch a doorknob. It's just really, really big. And so if you think about when you get shocked by a doorknob, usually rubbing something against something, like sneakers against a wool carpet. And in volcanic eruptions or really big forest fires, you got that rubbing of particles against one another that builds up static electricity. Mm. And then, boom, the lightning seeks to do it. I imagine John and I are both imagining the picture.
Yeah.
We've seen it, and
it's a great
picture. It's really amazing.
It is really amazing.
And it's
picture.
Not the only one. There are a whole bunch of really good ones from that Iceland volcano. Yeah. It's that one.
Bill in Madison has a comment or question. Hi, Bill.
Hi, guys. Thanks for the great program. I've got a question. We've got the big snowstorm on the East Coast, and it's picking up moisture over the ocean. Is there a difference between that snow and snow, say, generated over the Great Lakes? Is there a difference in volume or content or anything?
Maybe because of the salt of the ocean, you're thinking?
Right.
Yeah, the salt doesn't get evaporated. That's a good question, but the salt doesn't get evaporated. It's only the water does. But the fetch, the distance across which the air that's moving across the ocean is available to pick up water vapor, is enormously different. And as a consequence, by the time some of the air that's come all the way out from, you know, Georgia's Bank today, hundreds of miles off of Cape Cod, finally makes its way into northeastern Massachusetts to bury my hometown, it's had an ample opportunity to pick up a lot of water vapor. And so it dumps a huge amount of snow. The same kind of cyclone, the circulation and everything and the structure of the circulation placed in the Midwest would simply be starved for the water vapor that the storms on the East Coast can deliver. So, you know, you're getting 2 feet of snow maybe in Central Park today. I guess it's more like 16 inches, maybe the same at Boston. Such a thing would be an 8-inch or 7 or 8-inch snowfall for us in Milwaukee, Madison, because we just can't ingest that tremendous amount of water vapor.
So just the other question I have for this is that I agree that it's the fetch, but the Gulf Stream is also going to be a lot warmer than the Great Lakes.
Yeah, that's true.
So is it going to be heavier snow, wetter snow than we would get from Great Lake effect snowfalls?
If you're far enough back and the temperature is in the mid-20s, it won't make any difference at all. if you're close to the line, like the megalopolis, the cities from Boston through Hartford, Connecticut, through New York to Washington, they're aligned in such a way that it's very often the case that their temperature is right around 32 degrees Fahrenheit, the freezing point, when it's snowing heavily there. Today it's a little bit colder in both of the big cities, Boston and New York. But when it's not, the snow is more like concrete, the kind we got on December 11th, that heavy, wet snow. But I don't think it has to do with the warmth of the Gulf Stream directly in making the snow that way. But the warmth of the nearby Gulf Stream makes it more likely that you're going to have warm air to get in, mixed in there, close to the ground, and make it closer to freezing.
Interesting.
There you go. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, guys.
Ron in La Crosse. Hi.
I have a question regarding the Fahrenheit scale, and I have a theory as to why it is. Why is the freezing point of water on a Fahrenheit scale at 32 instead of zero? Would it have anything to do with the fact that that's just the freezing point of fresh water and not seawater?
That is exactly it. And I rail against people who say, see how stupid the Fahrenheit scale is because 32 is such an arbitrary number. No, it's not arbitrary. If you're from a seafaring nation and you want to measure when the water freezes, you're not going to measure when the clear, pure water freezes. You're out at sea. You want to know when seawater freezes, and that's about 0 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's far from arbitrary.
Good theory.
You are right on.
You're right on. Thanks, Ron. Thanks very much for calling. And here we are out of time.
Wow.
Wow.
That was right on, too.
A lot of great questions today.
Yeah, that was.
Yeah. Let's look forward to January.
Yep.
Yeah, well, and I expect that I will see you guys next year.
You will.
That is correct.
The last Monday of the month, I'm going to guess.
Yeah, the last Monday. And I'm not sure what day it is, but it's the last Monday.
It's the last Monday of January.
We'll be back in school and teaching again.
Yeah, that's right.
There we go.
Looking forward to that.
Thanks, guys. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John Martin chairs the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Tomorrow we'll talk dermatology with Dr. Dick Niles. Thanks for listening. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.